hppodcraft.com.
I was born with luck as a twin, roared Fafford jovially, leaping up so swiftly that the cranky sloop rocked a little in spite of its outriggers. I catch a fish in the middle of the ocean, I rip up its belly, and look, little man, what I find. The gray mouser drew back from the fish-bloodied hand thrust almost into his face, wrinkled his nose with sneering fastidiousness, raised his left eyebrow, and peered. The object did not seem very small, even on Fafford's broad palm, and although slimed over a little, was indubitably gold. It was both a ring and a key, the key part set at a right angle so that it would lie along the finger when worn. There were carvings of some sort. Instinctively, the gray mouser did not like the object. It somehow focused the vague uneasiness he had felt now for several days.
That was the intro to the Fritz Leiber story, The Sunken Land, and our introduction to Fafford and the Gray Mouser.
Yes, finally. You know, Patton, if you remember, was selling us on these guys back initially when we talked to him about Fritz Leiber stories. He picked out some for us and talked about these guys a lot. And I could see why, if only for the phrase, I was born with luck as a twin. What? That's so great. That's going in the data banks for just the perfect moment.
Yeah, this is a wonderful story, and I feel like a schmuck for not having read any of this stuff before. But this month, we are all in full fantasy swing with swords and sorcery, a month I had dubbed Maytember.
Yes.
But how about we change it up to Amazing Fantasy Month?
Hey, that's pretty good. I mean, I like Maytember, but that seems a lot more reasonable of a name.
Yeah, well, I was up all night working on that one, and then I fell asleep, and I got up, and Rachel said, what's going on? And I said, inspiration!
Wow.
And then I wrote that down. Amazing Fantasy Month.
Comes to you in a dream, you can't deny it. Explains a lot of decisions I've made in my life. Who was that reader?
Oh, that is the amazing Sean Burnham. If you would like to hear more of him, head to his YouTube, where he does these great deep dives into folk songs. His latest is about the song Lampkin.
Yes, these are English folk songs. We're not talking about Woody Guthrie. He's done a few of these on songs like Hares on the Mountain, The Hungry Fox. Mm-hmm. I watched them, and it's really interesting stuff. We'll link out in the show notes so you can take it in as well.
Also, check out his music. He does some folk music on Bandcamp under the name John Dingo. So check that out, too. Now, we've covered some Fritz Leiber stories before on the show. Quite a few, actually. Roll the Bones, Space Time for Springers, The Girl with the Hungry Eyes, Terror from the Depths, To Arkham and the Stars. But we've never done a Fafford and the Gray Mouser story, which is arguably the stuff he's best known for.
It's all new to me, but I imagine if these had been more famous when I was younger, Fafford could have been my nickname. Sounds close enough.
All right.
Bye instead of what Fafford. It was, which was Fievel from American Tail, since that was out when I was a kid. Although, if we're being honest, I'm way more of a Fievel than a Fafford. So,
really?
Probably would have happened anyway. Well, he's got that dope hat.
He does. Now, Fafford is this red-haired, northern barbarian, kind of like a Viking kind of guy. And the Gray Mouser is a short, dark-haired rogue or thief. He also has a little bit of magical expertise, which I guess means he multiclassed at some point. Fafford is spirited and outgoing, optimistic, one might say, while the Mouser is a bit cynical. These stories are very Conan-like in the sense they like to drink and fight and have adventures and travel around. Their lot never really seems to change. They're always kind of the same dudes.
Mouser tells you a lot about the character. If you had cats, sometimes they're mousers. They're very active and they want to play, or they're the ditzy type who just have lost all instincts. It seems like it's one or the other.
Yeah.
It may be different in other stories between these guys, but they just seem to be like a couple of friends from this story. Mm-hmm. I didn't get that Lethal Weapon vibe where they're at odds, but they really need each other. I mean, they might have disagreements, but it isn't that sort of odd couple pairing.
Yeah.
Which is kind of how it was with the Necromancers last week as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's Sword and Sorcery Month, but it looks like it's also about friendship this month. The only ship that can save you from the sunken land.
Yeah, well, I read that these characters are based off Leiber and his buddy Harry Fisher, who was the guy that actually came up for Fafford and the Gray Mouser in a letter to Leiber.
I read in the Wikipedia entry, one of Leiber's motives for writing them was to have a couple of fantasy heroes closer to true human nature than the likes of Howard's Conan the Barbarian or Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan. So they're meant to be a little more realistic.
And have like a real friendship and a real relationship.
Yeah.
In 1936, Leiber finished the first Fafford and the Gray Mouser novel, Adept's Gambit, but it wasn't published until 1947.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I complain about some of these release periods, but wow, 10 years. It looks like he knocked a bunch of these out. On my further reading, I read the stories of these two heroes were only loosely connected until the 1960s when Leiber organized them chronologically and added additional material in preparation for paperback publication. Starting as young men, the two separately meet their female lovers, meet each other, and lose both their lovers in the same night, which explains both their friendship and the arrested adolescence of their lifestyles. I like that. You know, they would have settled down, but this tragedy happened. I assume it's tragedy and they didn't just get broken up with. Although that would be a great story as well if they just got dumped. Yeah. However, in later stories, the two mature, learn leadership, and eventually settle down with new female partners on the Iceland-like Rime Isle. Leiber contemplated continuing the series beyond this point, but unfortunately died prior to doing so.
Oh. Now, these stories take place in the world of Nuon, which is actually Nowen spelled backwards, with Lankmar being its great city. And later stories, you find out they're part of a multiverse, and there's spaceships and all that jazz. But this story that we're covering right now is firmly set in fantasy. The Sunken Lands was first published in Leiber's first book, Night's Black Agents, which was published by Arkham House in 1947. The story was thought to have been written originally in 1940, but nobody's quite sure if that's true. I got this in a collection called Swords Against Death, and that was originally published in the 1970s. It was the second Fawford and the Grey Mouser collection. The one before that was Swords and Devilry, and after that was Swords in the Mist, Swords Against Wizardry, Swords of Lankmar, Swords and the Ice Magic, and lastly, The Knight and the Knave of Swords.
Clearly there's a theme there. Friendship, once again. It's interesting to think about, actually, it's obviously Swords. Knave of Swords really sounds like a Game of Thrones mockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
Or, you know, the USA Network answer to it or something. It's interesting to think about how friendships are used in the story, though, or in stories in general. Uh-huh. I was thinking about this, reading this, you know, when it's a two-hander, you got two main characters. Hmm. Oftentimes you'll have a main character and a sidekick. That's a little different. Here, it's definitely two people in the lead, even if one you track with for a while.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about, you know, why make that writing choice? And often it is that lethal weapon paradigm in which you use the characters to show different points of view or different approaches, the veteran and the rookie, the crazy guy and the by the book guy who trend towards solidarity to solve a problem. You know, we need both sides of this if we want to beat the antagonist. And those kinds of stories, they almost can't help but be about, look at what we can do if we bridge our differences to an extent.
Yeah.
And then you have stories, which we do sometimes, and we did last week, where a friendship is a means of turning against the world. It's not necessarily a good thing. A single person who's having their worst impulses pushed down by a normalizing society suddenly meets somebody whose interests are the same, you know? So it's like Sid and Nancy or the guys from The Hound, you know, Empire of the Necromancers. It's right. Like, you know, you're a drinker and then you meet that other drinker and you two disappear. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then there's this story, and I don't know if the others are like it, but here friendship is actually a superpower.
Yeah.
Don't listen to Skeletors. They're always going to say your weakness is your friends, but the truth is, in a more real world, if you are loved, you have a tremendous advantage in most situations.
Oh, yeah.
The most obvious of which is if you go missing, someone's going to look for you.
Yep.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And Super Friends stories in their character development, I like them a lot because they tend to focus less on the clashes between the people and more on what makes each of them unique and why they're a good team and why they're fun to hang out with. So, you know, like when you meet the Three Musketeers, you think these guys are great. I could totally see why they're friends, you know, and it's like one of my favorite kinds of stories, which is why I think I keyed into this so hard right away.
Yeah, this is a great story and I'm excited to talk about it. So let's not dilly dally anymore and get into it.
Yeah.
The Sunken Land. Fawford and the Grey Mouse are on a small boat at sea on their way back to Lankmar. Fawford has used a bow and arrow with a cord on it to harpoon a fish. When they're gutting this fish, they find this amazing ring inside of the fish. Now, the ring has got a key built into it that lays flat on your finger when you wear it, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
The Mouser, he immediately doesn't like it because he's been around and he doesn't recognize the style of it. And that means it's either very old or very evil, or probably both. So he tells Fawford, get rid of that thing. But Fawford just laughs off Mouser. He's superstitious.
Yeah.
So he keeps the ring, he puts it on, and he goes back to fishing.
A little bit of a Gollum, Lord of the Rings vibe right away with the fish and the ring. Yeah. But, you know, I don't think you need the supernatural obsession, although there is a little bit of mysticism going on here. I just think if you find a cool ring in a fish belly, you're keeping it. That's not going to happen again.
No, that is a once-in-a-lifetime experience for sure.
I mean, how many times has it happened to you?
Zero.
Me too. There is a little bit of a mystical significance to the ring for him. It says the carving on the ring part, as far as one could make out,
represented a sea monster dragging down a ship.
Okay.
In Farford, it roused strange memories, recollections of certain legends told around flickering driftwood fires, firelight glimpses of certain bits of loot taken by some unaccountably distant ancestor, and considered too traditionally significant to barter or sell, or even give away. Ominously vague warnings used to frighten little boys who were inclined to swim or sail too far out. So there's something in childhood stories about this that means, you know, he looks at it, he might, maybe should know better, but it's too cool.
Now, like I said earlier, Fawford has long copper red hair and a beard. He's almost 7 foot tall. They don't tell you that in this story, but in the other stories, you find out he's really big. He dresses in brown clothing, leather slippers. He's got a long sword, but he doesn't wear any jewelry or ornaments. Well, except for this newly found ring.
I liked in the writing, it says, light leather slippers, easily kicked off, were on his feet. That's the description. I thought, what are you setting me up for here, you know? They'd get to an island and the natives would say, you cannot enter with shoes. And Fawford be like, easy, watch this. Good thing that was set up or I wouldn't have believed he could get barefoot that fast. Or another suitable payoff would have been if a slipper flew off and knocked out a pursuing monster, just knocked him right out. That would have been amazing. But no payoff. I guess it was just something he wanted me to know.
Yeah. Now, Monster, on the other hand, is short. He's just over 5 foot tall and he wears gray clothes and a hooded tunic. He's known for fighting with a sword and a dagger at the same time. That's his MO.
Yeah.
Now, Fawford says the style of the ring reminds him of stories that he heard as a kid of the lost land Simorgia.
Right. This is more than just something he half remembers. He actually goes, no, wait, it's this lost land of Simorgia, now yes. That I think about it.
Mighty magicians ruled it long ago. His people went on raids against it, but only one ship ever came back from their place. But according to legend, it sank into the sea and no one ever found it. Mouser suggests that they might be sailing over it right now.
May not that very fish you caught have swum in and out of the windows of those towers?
So Fawford says none of it may be true because legend makers are great liars. Mouser tells him, just get rid of it. You don't need it. It's a bad omen. Then Fawford's mind wanders and he sees the land of Simorgia as it once was, alive with the ancient industry of commerce strong with alien wizardry. That his imagination turns to a galley of his own people rowing to face the unknown.
Which makes it sound a little heroic, face the unknown, but the phrase in the story is actually, the faces of the warrior rowers were exultantly eager, dominated by the urge to rape the unknown.
God.
Cut to Gene Roddenberry reading this story. Oh, I guess I can't use that phrase in my script now. Well, how about explore strange new worlds? Maybe that'll work. God. He spared us.
So as night falls, Mouser lights the lantern and it's his turn to sleep. And then at midnight, it's Fawford's turn to sleep. But Fawford's awoken because the weather has turned and they are in a bit of a storm. Mouser needs help getting the boat back under control.
It's a really nice balance of sailing lingo and the action without losing me. Yeah. I had a pretty good idea what was going on the whole time. I don't always when it's a boat story.
Yeah. Now, once under control, Mouser tells Fawford to throw the ring away because this bad weather's coming because he's wearing the ring. And Fawford still doesn't think the two are connected. Then out of the darkness, Fawford sees the dragon-headed bow of a galley. And this is a type of boat that his people would use. And he's shocked by it. He doesn't move. He just stares at it because he wasn't expecting to see it. He's so shocked that when the sea gets rough and turns the boat, he doesn't notice that the mast is swinging and it comes around and it knocks him into the water.
It's pretty scary for a giant vessel to appear out of nowhere. They were describing that they're completely surrounded by water.
Yeah.
So you think you'd have seen this coming, even in the dark, you know, a shape or something. I mean, that's like, you ever close your eyes when you're in the bathtub and then you open them up and someone's in there with you? It's like that.
Strangely, yeah.
Yeah.
That does happen to me.
Sure. Well, you know, Levi, it must have happened to you. He waits till your eyes are closed. I don't know how he does it.
I didn't even know he was in town and he'll be there. Fawford gets to the side of the Viking boat and is able to climb up into it, but he's attacked immediately by a blonde-haired man. Then Fawford grabs that guy and pulls him over into the water.
Yeah, that's some quick acting, fast thinking. He gets knocked out, grabs an oar, kills a guy on his way up to the new ship. He's just really adaptable, I'm learning about Fawford.
Yes. He climbs up over the side and sees many men rowing. Two of them grab swords and come at him, and another one from behind.
And he grabs a sword from the rack himself, starts fighting these guys right away. And maybe it seems like they came from their book club or something, because it says he dodged a swashing blow and parried an unexpected backhanded slash from the same weapon. Stale, sour wine fumes puffed into his face. So these guys have been drinking wine.
Now, someone takes an oar and puts it between Fawford and the men. It's this little Weasley guy. Also, strangely, he notices nobody's saying anything. Everybody's silent. So usually when you attack, you know, it's like, ah, but they're not doing anything. They're just quiet.
Yeah. It was a dud in book club too, so they're all kind of morose about that. They read Wuthering Heights. Oh. Nobody wants to admit they didn't get through it.
The boat lurches in the storm and water gushes in. He knows this boat can't take it, so he jumps to one of the oars and he helps stabilize their ship.
That was a really cool turn of events. He vaulted up out of another breaking wave onto the poop and added his strength to that of the lone, struggling steersman. So he just jumps out of the fight, which he was doing pretty well in, I think.
Yeah.
And but here the real superpower comes out, friendship. He goes, hey, you know what? Put all this aside, I'm going to help you guys.
Well, also, a little self-serving, because if this boat's going to capsize, he's going back in the water.
That's true.
After he helps getting the boat under control, he draws the sword again, but he knows he can't fight them all. So he doesn't put up a fight. He says he just helped save everyone. And the captain comes up. This is this younger blonde guy. He comes over to him, but he doesn't say anything. Fawford says to this leader, what do you intend? Weigh well the fact that I saved your ship. And the guy says nothing. He just points to where the empty rowing seat is. And Fawford thinks, oh, I bet you that's the seat of the guy I just threw overboard. Okay, seems fitting. So he gets to rowing.
Again, so adaptable. You know, he got hired in the interview and he just went with it. For me, I'd be like, no, I can't start today. I got to go home and wonder if I made a huge mistake for a few days. We'll get to this Monday, okay?
The little guy, who's old and weaselly, he comes up. He's a Mingle and a slave. And Mingle is the world's equivalent to somebody from Mongolia. He's a Mongolian fella. Now, he talks, and he explains that he's not part of this oath of silence since he's just a slave. He keeps the guys fed and drunk. The captain is Lavis Larrick. The slave tells Fawford that he can't talk now because he's part of the crew, so he's got to keep his mouth shut.
This guy's like R2-D2, just serving drinks and loving it. And he says, now you know what Lavis Larrick feeds his oarsmen. There are few crews in this world or the next one that row on wine. That's because it made me sick even thinking about it, you know? I was born with luck as a twin, is said more often. Then let me chug this wine and we'll do some rowing. You know, let me get a little of this white Zin down and we'll take a quick jog. Not something you ever hear. It's not a good pairing. That's the one place where there is no wine pairing. with intense physical activity.
The slave explains that Lavis has sworn to raid Simorgia. He swore an oath to his mother, whom he hates, and he killed the man for saying that the whole thing was a bad idea.
Yeah, this was psychologically something to behold. Lavis Larrick swore a great oath before his mother, whom he hates worse than he hates his friends. Which was, it's such a strange detail.
He also explains that Lavis hates all men who are sober, and as part of his job, the slave has got to keep everybody fed and drunk, but unfortunately they're out of food and almost out of booze. And these guys are going to mutiny in the morning because Lavis is nuts.
Yeah, and because they got drunk and rode all night, it says next morning there will be aching backs and sick guts and pain-hammered skulls. And I was glad that this was addressed. You know, it's a really cool bad guy plot. Instead of just blandly having these bandits out in pursuit of greed, I like the idea that this guy is going after this stupid goal, knowing himself that it's probably a stupid goal, but he's doing it to show his mom that she's wrong. She said he can't do it, and he can. And the reason he hates sober people is because they're going to point out that this is a stupid idea. He can't have that. And there's not a lot of time spent developing this backstory, but it's pretty clear, it's pretty unique, and it's surprisingly grounded. Yeah. I feel like things like that happen all the time.
And just then, Lavis stabs the slave and kills him.
This guy cannot handle criticism, and when he shows up, he proves it immediately.
This is not a common activity for him to do, just killing somebody in his crew, because when he does it, it unnerves everybody immediately. And it starts to feel like the mutiny is going to happen right then and there, but... A voice yells, Sigmorgia. And they look in the distance and they see it. It loomed up vast as a mountain and perilously close. A great black blot, vaguely outlined by the lesser darkness of the night, partly obscured by trailings of mist and scud, yet showing in various places and at varying distances squares of dim light, which by their regular arrangement could be nothing but windows. It's actually closer than they think. They row toward it and it crashes into some jagged rocks. The boat is broken. But they don't care. They're so excited that they found this place. They just get off the boat and they're ready for a raid.
It says, serve out weapons and wine. Always a great idea. It's that reminds me of a long time ago. Rachel and Heather and I went out roller skating to some after party where it was booze laden roller skating.
Oh, boy.
And I remember going there and thinking, this seems like a bad idea. But I guess it'll be fun. Everybody got injured.
I still have an injury from it. This was like 12 years ago. My thumb still doesn't work right. Same thing. Serve out weapons and wine. This will be great.
They get out their torches. They light them up. Lavis sees something glint on Fawford's hand. It's his ring. And then he recognizes it as a ring of Simorgia. He tells the man to seize Fawford, and he takes the ring. This man is a Simorgian spy, or perhaps a Simorgian demon who has taken the form of a northerner to allay our suspicions. He climbed out of the sea in the teeth of a roaring storm. Did he not? What man among you saw any boat? And then one guy pipes up and goes, I saw the boat. Lavis shuts him down real quick.
So funny. This guy cannot handle criticism of any kind. No. He just, it was such a funny idea to have that guy pipe up. No, actually, I saw a boat. It was really clear. No, shut up. We're going with what I think.
Lavis decides that Fawford is going to take them to where the good treasure is stored.
And he doesn't ask Fawford any routine questions about whether he's been here before, if he actually is from Simorgia, all the things he assumes. He just goes with, show us the good treasure.
Yeah, at first they're sneaky, but they don't see any signs of people, and they're all drunk, so they start making noises. They're even singing sea shanties. They ask, where's your guards, to Fawford? And Fawford's like, I don't know, man. This ain't my place. Yeah. Obviously, he knows they're not going to believe him. They come to what is either a natural wall or the wall of a castle. They're not quite sure. They find a big entrance with light coming from it. But inside, they can see the walls and the floors. Everything inside has this phosphorescence glow to it. Lavis leads his men inside. Inside, it's all wet and oozy, and they find carvings.
An endless series of vague carvings, wherein sea monsters and unwholesome man-like figures and vaguely anthropomorphic giant skates or rays seem to come alive and stir as the phosphorescence fluctuated. So it's like a cross between Cthulhu's and those scary fur sheets from Yovambis, you know?
Yeah.
They're flat. It's scary, those stingrays and skates. They're just mobile, basic shapes. I'm not a fan. They creep me out.
So Fawford is thinking, you know, these guys gotta know that this place just came out of the sea. There's still fish flopping around inside, but it doesn't stop them. They finally come to a room with a large table and an octopus sitting in one of the chairs. But Lavis says that this is the treasure room. And he's right. There are a bunch of treasure chests. He gets one of the guys to go over to the chest. And as he goes to open it, the thing just kind of falls apart in this oozy, gross mess. But inside, golden gems.
A golden gem. And I think the octopus is a statue of some kind or something. It says he distinguished an octopus shape slouched there in a travesty of a human occupant. Tentacles coiling the chair. Unblinking eyes staring glisteningly. I got the impression maybe that was a statue. It'd be kind of odd if a octopus really was just sitting there at the chair having a cup of tea.
But it says it was the occupant of the chair. I think it was the octopus was just hanging out there because there's fish flopping around. There's all these undersea creatures that got stuck in here when it came up out of the sea. I thought it was an octopus.
Oh, maybe it is. In my head, I thought maybe it was a cool Cthulhuid kind of humanoid thing that was he sort of saw, but actually you're right. It probably is just an octopus in a chair like I was making fun of. I'm reading it now. Yeah, I think you're right.
They all run and start going for the treasure, but not Lavis. Fawford notes that he's looking for something. He's really focused and he's scanning the room and then he finds a door with a keyhole. And then Fawford notices that Lavis has his ring on and it's a key to a door. He's going to open the door.
It says, then he realized, and the realization came with an impact like a rushing wall of water, that nothing had happened accidentally, that everything from the moment his arrow struck the fish had been intended by someone or something, something that wanted a door unlocked. And he turned and fled down the corridor as if a tidal wave were sucking at his heels. So it seemed a little random for him to find this ring at the beginning. Uh-huh. And it seems like he's just part of some big skate dinner plot, which is cool.
Yeah.
I like it.
I like it too that
he
comes to that realization. Like he seems a little bit smarter than your normal protagonist. He's like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, yeah. No. And he just gets the hell out of there. Fawford, he scrambles out. He runs like hell. He falls down, gets back up. He hears this voice being called right as he gets outside. And it's the Gray Mouser. He's on the shore with their boat.
It's friendship, just perfect blandship.
Fawford hauls ass to the boat. He begins getting it ready to sail. Mouser tells him, oh, pull up the anchor, and he just cuts the rope. He ain't playing.
To Gray Mouser's credit, he does the job. He lets the whole conversation go until later. You know, we can catch up on this. Let's go ahead and flee, which is admirable. To me, I would need information. I wouldn't be able to. I'd get us killed. I go, whoa, what's going on? Explain it to me first, Dad. So good on you, Gray Mouser.
They sail off into the darkness, but the water gets choppy, and finally these huge waves start coming in, and they have to fight to keep the boat afloat, but they do. And finally, it calms down, and the sun begins to rise.
It turns out, you know, he was worried about the integrity of the boat earlier, but having this small boat was lucky for them, because a larger craft would have been pulled apart by these massive waves.
Yeah. Now, so Fawford knows that Mouser looked back at the island as they left, but he didn't dare to. Except he still wants to know, so he asked Mouser what he saw.
The Mouser shrugged his shoulders. I don't know. The distance was too great and the light was queer. What I thought I saw was rather foolish. I'd have given a good deal to have been closer. He frowned, shrugged his shoulders again. Well, what I thought I saw was this. A crowd of men wearing big black cloaks, they looked like northerners, came rushing out of an opening of some sort. There was something odd about them. The light by which I saw them didn't seem to have any source. Then they waved the big black cloaks around as if they were fighting with them or doing some sort of dance. I told you it was very foolish. And then they got down on their hands and knees and covered themselves up with the cloaks and crawled back into the place from which they had come. Now tell me I'm a liar. Fafford shook his head. Only those weren't cloaks, he said. But then, what was the place? I mean, the island that almost sucked us down when it sank. Simorgia, said Fafford, and lifted his head and began to grin in a cruel, chilly, wild-eyed way that took the Mouser aback. Simorgia, repeated Fafford, and pulled himself to the side of the boat and glared down at the rushing water. Simorgia, and now it's sunk again, and may it soak there forever and rot in its own corruption till all's muck. He trembled spasmodically with the passion of his curse, then sank back. Along the rim of the east, a ruddy smudge began to show.
What a great story.
Yeah, really good. And, you know, it's funny. It seems like we do a Risen Island story, you know, every couple of months. We went through this and really didn't talk about it that much because it's got enough stuff to offer outside of the core concept of this yeah. Atlantean idea that we've seen so many times. And mm-hmm. that's really great that you could capture my interest this much on a topic that I've read ad infinitum about.
Yeah, it's just really well written, interesting characters. And like I said, I picked up this collection for this story and I'm inspired to read the whole thing just because I enjoyed it so much. It's fun.
It was pure escape when I read this. I looked at it at first and it was kind of longer than what we've been doing. And I thought, ah, great. And then it was over. It took me away. And I really liked it. Speaking of great characters, Sean Burnham, way to read for this show.
Thank you, Sean, so much for your awesome talents and skills. Go check him out on YouTube. He deep dives into some English folk songs, and it's a really fascinating stuff. Also, check out his music on Bandcamp under the name John Dingo.
I'd also like to thank some of our patrons for making the show possible, and I'm going to start with Josh W.
I'd like to thank Ethan Lorcher.
I'd like to thank Rodri Gardner.
Artur Litwin, thank you.
Reina Anguico, thank you.
Jesse Holman, thank you.
Marcus Mick, thank you.
Anders Benson, thank you very much.
Blackbird 43210, you're one in a million.
And
thank you.
Lastly, thank you, JC Mags, for your support. You guys are all awesome. If it wasn't for you, Chet and I wouldn't be doing this.
It's true.
We'd be, I don't know, working at the massage parlors. That's reputable work.
It's one option of many, but it is a possibility. Yeah. We're not exactly sure what sword and sorcery we're going to tackle next in amazing fantasy, May I Stab You May, but it's probably going to be a good one. That's my guess.
Yeah, it's going to be great, and I'm looking forward to talking about it next week. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. You've been listening to HP Podcraft.
Strange studies of strange stories.
HPPodcraft.com. Ah!